Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison's monthly meeting. Our speaker today is Susan Hagstrom.
All right, so I'm going to talk about interesting tidbits in atheist and agnostic history. I've just been reading about it. I'm not like an expert or anything like that. So first of all, ancient Greeks. Studying atheists and agnostics in ancient Greece is an interesting test on interpretations. First of all, due to the way ancient Greece treated their mythology, there was an underlying back and forth detailing whether or not, you know, they have the gods, but there's so much sort of image and that sort of thing that, at least in Battling the Gods, he argues that it's more of a mythology and less of an actual belief. Also, in Grecian law, there was apparently two forms of what they called atheism. Disbelief in the gods altogether, which they called atheos, a and theos for the god, and then what they called nomizein, which is not recognizing the gods, which could be either in not engaging the daily rituals, you know, put down your little sacrifice to Apollo or whatever, or it could be ignoring the household gods in favor of some sort of amorphous ideal. And that you could go to trial for either. Socrates, for example, is the one that went for an amorphous ideal, went to trial and killed himself for that. But, and it doesn't necessarily, the surviving paperwork doesn't necessarily say which one, some of these guys got arrested for one or the other. So you have to really pick and choose. So there are four characters with the most evidence found in ancient Greek who fit the category. And one of them, Socrates, he was more, as I say, he was more likely to be arrested for the nomizein. The way they describe it, he was sort of having a personal chat line to a single voice in his head instead of going on with the household gods at all. So he wasn't exactly doing the proper thing. So Democritus is probably the first atheist that they can find in historical writings. Although he probably wouldn't have called himself that, he's probably more well known for being the first evidence they could find of anybody saying the world is made out of atoms.
Is so, made out of what?
Atoms.
Oh, what year was that?
Ooh, I didn't memorize the year.
Several hundred BC.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it's like 300-400 BC.
They knew there was a time.
No, they theorized it.
Theorized.
That was his guess at the time, but he turned out to be onto something.
Mm-hmm.
Who named it Adam?
He did. Yep.
It's a Greek word? Or?
Yeah. It is a Greek word, definitely. Okay, so when battling the ancient Grecian version of what we nowadays call intelligent design or the watchmaker theory, his response was to hypothesize an infinite number of worlds. So that basically is saying, you know, if you have an infinite number of worlds, the chance that one world will have life isn't that much of a chance. I mean, it's, you got 50, infinite amount of worlds, and then there's one world with life, that's, you know, an easy throw of the dice that one world will have life. He did talk of souls, which he basically equated to the mind, so the mind is equal to the soul. And then he did say gods, but he went with two ways of gods. First of all, the normal gods out there, Apollo, Zeus, etc., were basically because primitive saw signs of nature, wondered at it, and attached a god to it, is one way that he talked of gods. And the other way he talked of gods was as dreams in sleep.
Dreams in sleep.
So they come to you when you're asleep, and they give you messages and stuff like that. As usual with that sort of argument, you know, there's nothing saying why everything else is complete baloney in your dreams, but a so-called god in your dreams is an actual god, you know. But he did do that sort of thing. So that's also sort of a common Greek methods of keeping gods when you create a philosophical argument that doesn't really fit any gods. Battling the Gods has a long chapter on Epicureans, for example, and Epicureans, nowadays Epicurean sort of things, you know, you have a nice fancy meal, you're being Epicurean or something. And this time, Epicureans was more philosophy of forget your anxieties and your troubles, etc., and do your best to live life for joy, etc., and that sort of thing. So I'm going to read 191. Where's that poem? There it is.
How did Epicurean or Israel, how did that get connected with food?
Through the ages, because they were more into senses than anything else.
He maintained that the highest attainment in life was sitting in your garden, eating with your friends. It was a physical mm-hmm. enjoyment. And I always read it like that. I later learned that there was a reason why he wanted to be sitting in his garden with his friends. He was lame. He couldn't walk. So the philosophy conformed to his circumstances a little bit. But I still like the idea of sitting in your garden, having a nice meal with your friends.
He didn't say a field, he said his garden.
Yes.
So he must have enjoyed the beauty.
He actually built a garden outside of Athens, and apparently after his death, they tried to make it and succeed from Athens, so it was a separate little municipality by itself, because he had a great many followers. So I'm going to read a sort of odd little poem they have here on the gods and nature, because it sort of fits into the sort of topic of Democritus here. There was a time when humans' lives were unordered, bestial and subservient to violence, when there was no reward for the noble or chastisement for the base. And then it seems to me humans set up laws so that justice should be tyrant and hold aggression enslaved. Anyone who erred was punished. Then when laws prevented them from performing open acts of force, they started performing them in secret. And then it seems to me some shrewd man, wise in his counsel, discovered for mortals fear of the gods so that the base should have fear, if even in secret they should do or say or think anything. So he thereupon introduced religion, namely the idea that there is a deity flourishing with immortal life, hearing in his mind, seeing, thinking, attending to these things, and having a divine nature, who will hear everything said among mortals and will be able to see everything that is done. If you plant some base act in silence, the gods will not fail to notice. And he sort of argues that that's more of a critique of religion and nature. Odd sort of thing. Okay, next fellow I'm going to talk about is Diagoras of Meleas. He's 5th century BC. And he's well known for the stories about him. So, for example, a well-known story that when a ship he was on ran into a storm, and the crew started going, "Oh, we're in trouble because we're carrying an atheist." He pointed to the ship next door and said, "Oh, do they have a Diagoras on board as well?" For example, that's one of another stories. Another story is that when Athens slaughtered the inhabitants of his home island, he said the lack of divine retribution against Athens was a sign of the non-existence of gods. Of course, Athens threw him in jail, and only a sizable bribe got him out. The battling the gods author does point out that at the time Athens was in a bit of a turmoil anyway, and may have just thrown him in jail to be rid of a sort of troublemaker type character. The title of his work that was known for about 500 years after this time, but had been lost since, was roughly translated as Arguments That Knock Down Towers. Towers. Sort of towers gods, you know, sort of gods on towers. He finally got in real trouble by revealing the mysteries of a mystery religion called Greek Eleusinian Mystery Religion.
Oh, really?
And it gave him one piece of silver for his capture, two for his death, so he can figure out how much more they wanted him dead than alive.
Translate that title.
What?
The one.
Greek Eleusinian Mystery Religion?
Yeah.
The book doesn't say what it is. I couldn't really find much about it anyway.
Oh. the same word?
It's apparently a mystery religion, so that the advantage was having your mysteries be secret, and then once you get devout, you figure out what the mysteries are. So if he reveals it to everybody, well, it's not much of a mystery anymore.
It's one of the secret religions about which we know almost nothing. Mm-hmm. There are others that we've since learned something about, like the cult of Mithras in times of the Roman Empire, mm-hmm. and one or two earlier ones. When you run around naked and get drunk in the woods, the word gets out, so we know more about certain religions than others.
Is that the same word as the illusion fields?
No, that's a lesion.
A lesion?
Yeah.
And he actually survived to die of old age, even though he had two symbols of death for his death posted for him. And then there was Theodorus of Cyrene. He was a philosopher influenced by the Epicurean thought of life. Increase of joy, rid yourself of anxieties, otherwise. An amusing note, Theodorus is basically roughly translated as beloved of the gods. Nice title for an atheist. His book was titled On the Gods. More of an agnostic than an atheist, he was known to have stated something along the lines that if there are gods, they have nothing to do with humans, so you might as well just go around and stop fearing them and worrying about them and just go and enjoy life. Yeah, phrase that's been going on for a while. Okay, I will also, I'm going to mention a few wonderful arguments from this book, Battling the Gods, which is a really lovely book. I do recommend it to everyone. And first of all, since he mentioned the Epicurean, one of the more famous ones was called Carneades. He was 214 to 129 BC. And he became the head of one of the Epicurean academies. And he had some absolutely wonderful arguments. Let's see. This one is called the Sorites or Heaping Argument, which is basically he created it to destabilize your belief in categories. So it pretty much goes that you can get the person to agree that a single grain is not a heap, and then two grains is not a heap. And, you know, you if it is not the case, 300 grains are a heap, but 299 are not. You cannot necessarily get somebody to agree with that. So where is the point where a single grain makes a pile become a heap? So he's using that sort of definition to work on it. And then Carneades would basically go, if the Olympians are gods, then what about the nymphs? And if the nymphs are gods, then what about Pan? And you're not about to call satyrs gods, because, I mean, who would call satyrs gods, apparently? So, where does the dividing line exist between one kind of immortal and another? Or take water. Poseidon, identified with the ocean, is a god. So are many rivers. But would we say every trickling stream is a god? How much water is required to qualify for divinity? As with the classic version of the Sorites, there's no single point where adding an ounce of water will convert a mere stream into a deity. No secure definition of God is possible, since there is no sharp boundary that separates the divine from the non-divine. Lovely argument, that one. I just love that one. Sextus, who was Roman, he was writing a bit past, and this is why we know a lot of the arguments that these guys were using, guys like Sextus. Among the other arguments that he presented that people used were the... I suppose this would be the more sort of logical types of argument. Example would be, if gods can make good decisions, are they then capable of making bad ones? So how do you know if it's a good decision if you can't make a bad decision? And if you can't make a bad decision, which gods are supposed to be all good, so why would they be going around making bad decisions? Can you truly have a god? Or the other one, to be virtuous. One must work at being virtuous. You don't exactly pop out of your mother's skull being virtuous. Since gods apparently know everything, they don't need to work at anything, so they can't be virtuous, so then are they non-virtuous gods? And this is the sort of arguments that the atheists were using at the time that he wrote. And then there's Protagoras. And in his argument for atheism was based on the sort of different types of evidencing that you can have. You know a person is sitting down if you go look at them and say, whoop, you are sitting down. That's sort of a witness type of evidence. And then two is sort of like the moon. At a time without telescopes, where these guys were living in, you don't always see the moon. Clouds, new moon, you know, and you don't have any moon going out there. So there's essentially no way to know that the moon exists unless it is visible. And then there's the three, which is sort of the other types of senses, so the honey taste. So one might find it sweet, the other bitter. And now, is that the same with gods? They ask. It's an interesting article. I'm arguing this, I find rather intriguing.
Can you go up that last one again, about sweet and bitter? How does that work?
Well, if you taste honey, one person might find the honey sweet, another one might find the honey bitter.
Right.
So there's a different evidence shows that it's a different thing for different people, so is it the same with gods? But more precisely, another way that he was arguing it is the Phoenicians say the gods are red-headed and white, mm-hmm. and the those guys over there say they're black-haired and whatever.
So
et cetera.
They couldn't see and didn't know where they were, they had bodies?
Yeah. Well, yeah, some of them did. I mean, the Epicureans, for example, thought gods were these very thin critters who lived in between different universes.
And you couldn't see them because they're too thin.
Yeah, and then they came in through your dreams. They were another one with dreams things. So, the Atheism for Dummies also lists several other interesting characters. We might want to be more than Grecian, you know, here. So, there's Confucianism. The guys may have studied more about Confucianism than I am. But he points out some more of a system of ethics than a god. And Atheism for Dummies lists two non-theist philosophers, Zun Yi, who thought humans were bad, but get good via education and discipline and all that. And then Mencius thought humans were good, but they were mucked up by bad influences in society. A quote from the line from Zun Yi sounds familiar. Don't thank or curse heaven, it's just the natural result of your own actions. If you want to have a better life, educate yourself and think carefully about the consequences of your own action. You could do that today, as a matter of fact.
That sounds like a fourth grade teacher.
Now, I was hardly amused that I did not know that the term Hindu was not actually created by any Hindus, but the Arabs to the west of the Indus River. It originally sort of meant something like, oh, those foreign people over there across the river. Hindus have a humongous amount of schools, as you probably know, and there are actually two that... One is that atheistic, they reject the notion of gods outright, called Samkhya. And the other is agnostic, using the gods, evidence for gods are pretty insufficient, and you might as well get along without them. That one is called Purva Mimamsa. Okay, and McGowan also mentions Jainism. He seems quite taken with it too. Jainism apparently rejected the notion of any supernatural beings, including God. So the Indian ethics of nonviolence and karma can be traced their roots back to Jainism. And now it's a fairly small sect, only about 6 million in India. He mentions a character called Janasena, who was a Jain teacher, and wrote the book Mahapurana. And he's... line that McGowan quotes is, how can an immaterial God create that which is material? Lovely argument. Okay. So another amusing thing that Dale McGowan did was he was reading the papers of a medieval inquisitor called Jacques Fournier, and he found examples of three atheists who were tortured by this inquisitor. And I'll read you the paragraph of the most evident one, called Raymond de Lair. And the most colorful of Fournier's suspects was Raymond de Lair, a villager who seemed like Diagoras reborn. Witness described Raymond saying that God never made the world, that the world had always existed, and that resurrection was a myth. that the Eucharist was nothing more than bread and wine, that the rituals of the priest meant nothing, and that he gave to the poor not for his soul, so that others could see him as a good man. At one point, he apparently told a friend that Christ was created not through divine intervention, but just through screwing like everybody else, and then struck the heel of one hand against the other repeatedly to underline the point. The witness assured Fournier that he told Raymond he was speaking evil and deserved to be killed. Whether he was actually killed wasn't recorded. Which makes you wonder. With that much of a definition, why didn't they record that he killed him? But they did. Okay. Now, just to note here that it's kind of interesting that I was asking around who's your favorite atheist in history, that sort of thing. And a lot of people mentioned this next guy, even though he's not actually an atheist or an agnostic, Immanuel Kant, including Atheist for Dummies. Not so much basically because he created what he thought the motto for the Enlightenment should be, Sapere Aude. I'm probably pronouncing that poorly. Basically translated as dare to know. He believed that no idea, including religion, should not be questioned, and if the valid, kept, if not, tossed. So, in a way, I mean, that could be considered the birthplace of modern atheism, in a way. If not atheism, agnosticism, definitely. Okay, and then just a few other characters mentioned. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, feminist, fighter for women's rights, was also an atheist. Quote, you can see a similar Enlightenment theme here. The quote is, the Bible and the church have been the greatest stumbling blocks in the way of women's emancipation. And we know her as the co-author of the 19th Amendment, which was passed 18 years after her death. And then, if you know your British history, Charles Bradlaugh, he was a confirmed atheist. He attempted to not take the oath of office in Parliament. He wanted to swear on loyalty instead of by a religious pledge. Got his election invalidated. Got reelected 4 more times by his constituents. They really wanted this guy. And then 6 years later, was finally allowed to take the oath by a loyalty pledge versus a religious pledge. With a little help from George Bernard Shaw. I do like my Shaw. Yeah, he was actually credited for setting up a new oath act, which made it so that any prospective member can affirm loyalty rather than a religious pledge. And I have to say, McGowan sort of details that nowadays there's about 100 people who took the loyalty oath versus the religious pledge in British Parliament. And then, if you thought Gandhi was totally religious, he actually hung out with an atheist called Gora. And Gora was working with the Untouchables, and with a series of interviews with Gandhi, he did manage to get Gandhi to agree that, yeah, he could work with atheists, and that two people coming from different places could work on the same problems. And then a very amusing one was Charles Chilton Moore, who was got irritated with the Bible, so he created a new paper called The Bluegrass Blade in Kentucky in 1884. It didn't make many friends. He would make such lines as, if there was a devil, Bourbon County is nearer and dearer to his heart than any place of its size on earth. And then he landed in jail for that one, actually. And then he just he really made friends by collecting and publishing letters from regular folks. He sent out a request for letters from atheists all over the country. And he published these letters. And for that, he got voted most hated man in Kentucky. He just really wanted to rub shoulders there. And that was just 1884, too. Okay, and then there's poet Pierce Shelley, who also made a name for himself. When in college, he wrote the treatise on the necessity of atheism. This was 1811. He ended up being expelled from Oxford once. His father got him back in. They tried to get him to renounce his treatise. He said, no way. And he got kicked out again. And went on to become English's greatest poet at the time. And then, of course, I should probably mention probably one of the most common names in agnosticism today, which is Robert Ingersoll. A very famous orator. He's really known for his orations, so I'm going to actually read two of them to sort of finish off. One, just in case you had an opinion about church and state, considering what Trump is up to. At present, the successful office seeker is a good deal like the center of the earth. He weighs nothing himself, but draws everything else to him. There are so many societies, so many churches, so many isms, that it is almost impossible for an independent man to succeed in a political career. Candidates are forced to pretend that they are Catholics with Protestant proclivities, or Christians with liberal tendencies, or temperance men who now and then take a glass of wine, or that although not members of any church, their wives are, and that they subscribe liberally to all. The result of all of this is that we reward hypocrisy and elect men entirely destitute of real principle. And this will never change until the people become grand enough to do their own thinking. Now, well, that's his oration on church and state. And what was the other one I wanted to read?
I didn't ever know that agnosticism was so frowned upon.
Well, it wasn't even labeled until the early part of the last century.
Mm-hmm.
But they knew it as an entity.
I don't think agnosticism is quite as frowned upon. The truly religious, I always think there's a possibility they can redeem you or something like that. So I don't think it's quite as frowned upon.
You're theoretically open to being convinced. That's one strain of agnosticism.
And this is sort of his speech that he gave, a paragraph of a speech he gave on why he became an agnostic. When I became convinced that the universe is natural, and that all the ghosts and gods are myths, there entered into my brain, into my soul, into every drop of my blood, the sense, the feeling, the joy of freedom. The walls of my prison crumbled and fell, the dungeon was flooded with light, and all the bolts and bars and manacles became dust. I was no longer a servant, a serf, or a slave. There was for me no master in all the wide world, not even in infinite space. I was free, free to think, to express my thoughts, free to live to my own ideal, free to live for myself and those I loved, free to use all my faculties, all my senses, free to spread imagination's wings, free to investigate, to guess and dream and hope. I stood erect and fearlessly, joylessly faced all worlds. We can fill our lives with generous deeds, with loving words, with art and song, and all the ecstasies of love. We can flood our years with sunshine, with the divine climate of kindness, and we can drain to the last drop the golden cup of joy. And of course, we might see a little theme of Epicurism in that. But so that's some of the characters I've been reading about in these several books. I also found, but I didn't get to manage to do it, FFRF recommends the Free Thought on the American Frontier if you want to read purely American historical atheists and agnostics and humanists. So I also recommend that book.
Oh,
there's some German stuff in this one. Yes, yes, yes. Yes.
Is there nowhere a mention of my personally favorite atheist, and that's Thomas Paine?
Oh, yes. I went for the more quirky, original ones,
well,
yes.
I mean, Thomas Paine, to me, is the one that just makes most sense, with greatest conviction, and who was mistreated worst in this country, of course. And on his deathbed, they wanted to get him to say something about, belief in something, even though he was too ill to be able to even deal with that sort of thing. But that his main work, I forgot the title of it, I'm sure you know it.
Age of Reason.
Age of Reason, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They actually...
It was cool. Thomas Paine was really cool.
And the funny thing is that he's actually a deist, which means that he's a one-God person.
You can argue.
So technically, they call him a deist. I'd probably call him a humanist because he was really arguing for reason over superstition.
Well, okay, you could argue about the term atheist. As far as humanist is good enough to me.
No, no book with Atheism for Dummies and Dale, Doing Right, and Dale McGowan is not exactly a bad guy. He's written some other lovely books. What was that other one he was
playing? Parenting about? Beyond Belief.
Parenting Beyond Belief, yeah, yeah. So no book is going to mention pain. I just thought everybody would know pain. So I didn't mention him to begin with, yes, no.
And that other book is written by Susan Jacoby.
Susan Jacoby, yeah. She's been writing a bunch of free thought stuff. This is her book on Robert Ingersoll, solely on Robert Ingersoll. He's really an interesting character. If you do get the FFFR newsletter, they've been redoing his statue down there in Illinois, was it?
Ingersoll's,
Yeah. So they pay attention to his stuff, too, even though he was an agnostic and not an atheist. But I don't think FFFR cares about that.
Well,
he's just a good guy.
FFFR is atheist, agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
Free thinkers.
Yeah. So that's a good book, and I do recommend that. And
she wrote an article recently called Sick and Tired of God Bless America.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, cool. It amazes me that we still use that governmentally. Yeah. And it's on our coins.
And all the politicians.
No, on our coins is not God Bless America, it's in God Trust.
Right.
That's but the God should be in there when so many people don't believe in God. Mm-hmm.
The general recognition that somewhere between 15% and 25% of the population are not theists is very recent. I mean, we're talking maybe a decade that's openly expressed.
When that was put in, like, what, the 40s or 50s or something like that?
What is?
And God We Trust on the bills?
I think that was the 50s. I think it was about the same time as
Joe McCarthy.
The McCarthy era and the advent of the presidential prayer breakfast, which Eisenhower really didn't want, but he decided he'd go to anyway.
And wasn't that in the 50s when the hymn was taken on or created, the national anthem?
The anthem is ancient.
Yeah, the national anthem.
Yeah.
was a poem written at the time of the War of 1812 and set to a British drinking song about Greek mythology, basically, or Roman mythology.
But I mean, it didn't become the national anthem until much, much later.
Yeah, it wasn't adopted officially.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The 50s were just a breeding ground for all this kind of crap.
I was appalled recently to learn that Australia did not adopt Waltzing Matilda as its official national anthem, but rather Advance Australia Fair, which is pretty upbeat.
Oh, is it?
Although, if you've never heard God Defend New Zealand, which does have the word God in its title, it's got a great tune. Mm. You can really tap your foot to that.
Oh,
yeah. Catchy music goes a long way.
Yeah. I just like to put in a plug also for the Buddha, who was basically a secular philosopher whose existence became deified by some but not all Buddhists a few centuries later, and who was asked a question about supernatural beings, said that that is a question that does not tend to lead toward enlightenment. Which is here we're talking several hundred years BC or BCE, and that's probably as good a definition of agnosticism as there is, because too many people think agnostic means I haven't made up my mind, whereas agnosticism basically rejects the question as being not beneficial to deal with.
Well, that's the most important tenet of the Gnosticism. They don't even want the question asked.
Yeah, it's calling the question making the question the issue.
Oh.
If Wikipedia is to be believed at all, and generally it's pretty good, there are kind of two basic philosophers, modern day philosophers, regard there are two kinds of agnostics. One who say that there's no way that answering the question, does God exist, is worthwhile. And there are those who say, I keep my mind open to the possibility that evidence will be found, but I haven't found it yet. An example of that would be Neil deGrasse Tyson.
And that's sort of my example. I'm sort of, every evidence I've seen so far, either too pro or con, is not worth it, so why bother? Not that I don't pay attention and look for things, but...
I'm so old and I can live with not knowing, basta, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, and so I won't worry about it.
I see no sense in doing anything.
The fair, the name of which I'm forgetting now,
Free Thought Festival.
The Free Thought Festival, the first one I went to, one of the speakers there that captured my imagination made a statement that was one of these things that if you left me alone on a desert island for 20 years, I wouldn't have come up with. But hearing once, you say, wow, that makes sense. Basically said it is possible to be an atheist with respect to the God of the Bible, but an agnostic with respect to the concept of God.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I mean, not that we didn't have permission to do that before, but I thought that kind of presented in three dimensions, but often is dealt with in two.
I tend to think most agnostics are atheists when it comes to organized religion.
Well, that depends, because Unitarian Universalism on the one hand and the Religious Society of Friends on the other, and there are probably aspects of Hinduism and other religions, are open to that as well.
There's another category that's not to believe in God, but to acknowledge other people's beliefs, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Don't force it on someone else.
Oh, that's exactly, I agree with you. But I always come back in the depth of my, in the hintertür, in the back door of my mind.
How many doors are there?
Well, quite a few. I'm open to argue.
Just open-minded.
But there is one thing that I always come back to, just personally. What about when you raise little children, and because they're not born with a set of ethics? I mean, I deny that little children are born with either good or bad or any kind of set of ethics. And I think all...
Right, you get to those two confusionisms. One is humans are bad and
They
get educated to be good, and the other one, humans are good and they get mucked up.
They have to learn somewhere and at some point a set of humanist ethics, you know, on how to do right by your fellow humans. They're not just born with that.
My first paid job was as a babysitter many, many years ago.
You have a good babysitter.
And I would argue that it varies from child to child, but some are born with a sense of ethics and some are not.
Yeah, and it also...
And at least one 71-year-old politician never developed a set of ethics.
That's fine. But I know the people from whom I learned most is my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, really good ethics, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make any difference when I say I do not believe there is a God.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying, where or when do you start with this idea, and how with little children,
mm-hmm.
so that it's good for them.
But that what you need is an understanding of what is not right.
Oh yeah, I know. But where do you get it?
Well, I have an example. When my middle son was two, and his brother was three. He took delight in biting his older
mm-hmm.
brother.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched his face. And it wasn't that he liked hurting him. Mm-hmm. He liked the change of his brother's face. And so finally, just to stop him, I took his little arm and I didn't bite it, I just lightly closed my mouth on it so he could feel it hurt.
Mm-hmm.
He never did anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I had
so he learned in that moment that hurting people. Mm-hmm. Before that, he was enjoying the expression.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
He thought it was fine.
And that was just,
so a limited limited amount of child abuse can be beneficial.
So a similar thing with two of my sisters when they were little. The one was that was older was very easygoing and mm-hmm. you know, get along. The younger one was always, you know, if her older sister had a toy, she wanted it. And she started biting the older one. Mm-hmm. And I was taking care of them one time, and the older one came in and looked at me, and I went into the other room, and I looked at the younger one, and I said, if you bite her again, I'm going to make her bite you back, because the older one wouldn't have been. And the younger one was like, oh, now I will get bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, she quit biting.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to go through that, but yeah.
Well, that strikes me as more Solomonic. You presented the threat of dividing the baby, and made people think through the situation. That's yeah.
Well, I think my little boy thought to himself, mm-hmm. realizing that making that expression on his face was about pain.
Mm-hmm. Well, how old was he at the time?
He was two.
So language wouldn't have been too useful at that point.
Well, I mean, the point is, if you read these characters in the history, I mean, yeah, there's a few quirks that editor of the Bluegrass Blade, who were just probably trying to poke fingers at people. But for the most part, if you read the philosophies, they do. The philosophies come out with almost a good sense of ethics, mm-hmm. along with whatever they're talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some areas where at least the author here for the Epicureans. He doesn't actually come out and say it, but his words are so weaselly, he thinks sort of the definition of these really thin particled gods who hide out between different universes and sort of a majestical void or some sort of thing, and only enter in sleep. So it's more like the Epicurean's method of, yeah, we got to say a god exists somehow, so we'll just, you know, paste on this sort of thing. Attached to our ethics sort of thing, but for the most part, they do come up with a good sense of ethics, mm-hmm. one way or the other. I mean, between the Stoics and the Epicureans and these atheists that they talk about.
I love to watch nature programs on public television, and when they've had some wonderful programs about mothering or fathering mm-hmm. of nature, of animals. And it's so fascinating what animals, like big animals like elephants, how they do, how they take care of kids, how they take care of each other. And you just,
yeah,
you keep, and you watch, and you watch, or I watch this and I think, if only people would have these mm-hmm. quote-unquote instincts, you know.
But in,
I think
in
they do.
In fairness,
I think
though.
They do.
Maybe they do, but they do. I mean, they're not developed until much later.
I think they're developed if they get
twisted. Yeah, right.
By the things that happen to
something
them.
Works that scrunches
them. Did, certainly share with you delight in that, in those concepts, but in mm-hmm. fairness, there are species that engage in cannibalism, and there are species that engage in extremely self-centered activities, and there are even human tribes that do.
There are some, but
the nature programs on television are going to be about
so
happy species, right?
Well, of course, but I mean, when you talk about elephants, you can't do a lot of cheating because they're such. You can't mm-hmm. overlook an elephant or these penguins.
What he's basically saying, though, is that it's the same way where if you get your ads for your net environmentalist things, they're not going to put the endangered earthworm on their ads to get you to give them money. They're going to put a lovely wolf through a forest or a polar bear or something
or
like that.
The elephants or the penguins. I mean,
yeah.
I think
you're
a lot about penguins.
And the bear.
What they're yeah. trying to do is get people to recognize there's a range of behavior.
Oh, yeah. That's all I'm saying.
A lot more than we always believe.
Yeah. I agree with you there.
I mean, but the story of, you know, the fox that adopts a chicken and they hang out together is always going to get discussed and broadcast.
That's not the rule. I'm talking about the rules of elephants or penguins for survival. There's large masses of very visible animals.
Right, there are entire species that have a very supportive, a communal relationship.
There have been two programs lately that you might not think they have in there. One of them is sloths.
Mm-hmm. The sloth,
yeah. Nobody is interested in sloths.
I didn't see that.
Until you see this, and you see the behavior of the sloth, and you find out there are a lot of things we didn't know about them that they do. Mm-hmm. And also that they're quite lovable and charming. And they don't look charming at all. And the other one was the wild African dog, which I always thought was a terrible species because...
The dingo,
No.
Not the dingo?
The hyena.
Wild dog.
Oh, okay.
It has some big spoon-shaped ears, like in the tin. And they go in packs, and then they just rip some living things to pieces, which of course other things do too, but it's not so messy. Mm-hmm. And it's not so exciting. All this going on. So I had taken a dislike to them, but then when I saw them in their natural behavior without people watching, and just behaving like dogs, very much like dogs.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because there's so many of them that you think they're awful. They're just behaving like dogs.
But when you say like dogs, you're talking about already civilized dogs. They've already been civilized by the
dogs. Domesticated dogs.
I use the term civilized.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, my dog, she's a cub, Weimaraner lab mix, and she's a darling dog. She's gentle and sweet, but she will rip a rabbit to pieces.
Oh,
and she found a nest of babies and she killed them all.
The most horrifying thing that I've ever witnessed were two very young kittens playing with a small squirrel.
Oh.
And you wanted them to either finish the thing off or let it escape, and that's not how they operate.
They're not operating in the terms of what it feels like.
Yeah.
They're operating in the terms of, I can catch this, I can do this to it.
Well, I need it for food, too.
Well, but they're learning how to do it. They're learning how to take care of themselves.
Yeah.
They're not really looking at it as being
Well, I think all the species are not looking at it in terms of ethical philosophy. They just have behavior patterns, some of which we like because they reflect our values.
You don't have to defend these animals against me because I know that there are stages in their development too. But I cannot help but when I watch these things of observing,
tenderness,
and pragmatism too. I mean, when the kid of an elephant really is so badly damaged by a lion or something, they will have to let the kid die because it won't live.
Mm-hmm.
No, they recognize that. Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
7th episode I saw recently was when giraffes gathered around the dead giraffe. All of them came from far distances to visit and recognize the death of the elder.
There was a little monkey that fell from a tree or something at one of these fields. A really young one. No, wait a minute. This is what happens when they do that. When a little one dies, all of them run around it.
Mm-hmm.
With this program, they had made some artificial animals to look exactly like it, made probably out of the skin of a rabbit, with a lens in the eye.
Oh,
camera.
Yeah.
And this little mechanical monkey fell to the ground, and all the monkeys were mourning that little mechanical monkey because it thought it was a little monkey.
Yeah, it took me a while to realize that the camera people had put that egg, that eye in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was kind of wrong.
The whole thing was mechanical.
Yeah.
The turtle could move.
Yeah. It's quite
amazing.
Yeah, it was amazing. As I say, it took me a while to get through my head.
Any more questions about the books?
I'm going to say here that Atheists for Dummies, if you've got anybody who's interested in starting, is a pretty good one. It's got like 3 chapters on historical atheists. And then chapter 11 is sampling important works that actually exist today that you can actually read. Lucretius, Confucian, Erasmus, Paine, Age of Reason. Let's see, and it goes on. Jefferson Bible. You guys have heard about the Jefferson Bible?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And paperback version.
And some Bertrand Russell, Ingersoll to read. So it's got a whole chapter of books that you can actually read.
Have you read anything about Immanuel Kant?
Yeah, it has a little thing. It doesn't actually have any books, but he's one of several that sort of was saying you have to mention Kant because he's sort of the model guy of the Enlightenment, and that you question things, and if they're actually valid, keep them. If they're not, toss it out.
I always argued with my major professor in German when I was in graduate school about Kant. I hated Kant.
He always spoke highly of you.
Oh, yeah. I didn't hear that.
I would really, if you have anybody who's interested in reading more about the characters in atheism and agnosticism, the book is Atheism for Dummies, but it has agnostics and even deists in it as well. And then, yes, I haven't finished this one, so I can't recommend it yet, but FRF does recommend that one. And this one, it'll be a big read. Took me forever, but I had other personal things going on as well. But Battling the Gods is a very good synopsis of ancient Greek and what the atheists were up to and what they have found, including apparently there's been some new documents in the last 20, 30 years that they have found that adds more into what's going on with the atheism in the ancient Greece. Mm-hmm. So he was able to write even more than maybe 20, 30 years.
So. Did those people, those atheists of long past, did they ever have association with one another? Did they have conferences or talk together?
Some of them that were doing the same time did.
They
had these academies and sort of went to basic, ancient Greek equivalent of school, shall we say.
And the Epicureans obviously had regular dinner parties.
So some of them did and some of them didn't. This actually covers from about, 6th century B.C. into partially into the Roman area, past the Judeo-Christian area. So it covers a good chunk of, 7-8 centuries of characters, so they wouldn't all sort of fit in together. But the other problem is that, as I say, what's the line? History is written by the winners. Which, in this case, would be, Judeo-Christian for these characters, Bible. So what you get is you get some of their writings. You get some of the writings from commentary about their writings. And then you get some of the writings from commentary about the commenters. Right? So you get a whole mix of sort of material.
Slants of view.
That's a good way to do it, though.
So, So they've collected information, and he's collected a lot of it, It does start off a little bit slow by going into mythology and how the mythology is not necessarily religious or literal. Sort of
I came to the conclusion when I was a graduate student here that Kant is much easier to read in English.
Really?
It's true.
Speaking of somebody.
I mean, I still don't like him because he never even moved out of his little confound where he lived in Ostpreußen, and he spoke about all this universal truth. And then it's amazing to find out when you study literature how many of the famous literature people, even Brecht, he knew his Kant from here to there. I mean, it's just my own.
Yeah. But speaking as somebody who has a command of English and a limited command of French, I find reading Kant in English is far easier than in German as well.
Thank you very much, Susan.
Yes, well done.